This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Welcome to the Ankler Podcast. This is Sean McNulty of the Wake Up Newsletter here at the Ankler here in New York City on Thursday, April 11th. I'm joined by Elaine Lowe in Los Angeles. Richard is trying his luck in Vegas this week, betting on the movie business at CinemaCon, or I'm guessing probably doing a thorough review of the new food options that'll be at movie theaters this year. Elaine, what are the odds that Richard tops his Barbie hat merch from last year?
Oh, I think it's going to be hard to top that, but we'll see.
That's a tough one.
I just want to see what kind of candy he brings back from the convention floor with their candy innovations.
Exactly. Stay tuned to the podcast for that. We'll be catching up with Richard a little later on. And with Richard in Vegas, we have Ankler executive editor David Litsky returning to join us this week. You know, Elaine, for a guy who said he'd rather not come back on the podcast on his very first appearance on this podcast, he sure is coming back a lot.
I know. I'm getting diva vibes, Sean. Diva vibes.
this is somehow miraculously my third week in a row, and I am delighted to be here. But yes, I am as surprised as you. I did prepare a obscure 1970s short-lived sitcom if you need it, but I'll just sit on that, but just know that it's available.
It's on his rider, Sean. Must make at least one obscure TV reference a week.
Keep it in the holster. Well, you surprise us whenever you like. We will eagerly await that one. But just a reminder before we get started, of course, you can catch the Ankler crew over on LA's number one NPR station and Southern California Public Radio's flagship radio station. That is 89.3 LAist throughout the day every Thursday as part of Entertainment Thursday programming during Morning Edition, Air Talk, and All Things Considered. And you can reach us here at the podcast anytime at podcasts@theankler.com. And of course, please vote for us in the Webbies. Elaine, did you figure out how to vote yet?
Yes, vote early, vote often. No, just vote once per person.
Get your voting clicker out. We'll be all set for the Webbies. The link is, of course, right there in the show notes for this episode. If you would take a moment and do us a solid, that'd be fantastic. Elaine, what did you get Warner Brothers Discovery for their two-year merger anniversary? Anything good?
What's the two-year? What is that, tin, wood?
Well, definitely don't get them WBD stock because that's down about 66% since that deal happened. So that's definitely not the way to go. But yes, the handcuffs are off, Elaine. Time to make a deal. Or, you know, the debt's down to $44 billion. I mean, that's good enough, right?
What a steal.
We can go buy things again. Yeah. Anyway, we shall see. Elaine, do you have some fond memories of the transition from the late 90s to the early 2000s?
Yes, I believe I was going into high school at that time.
You know, apparently Hollywood's been remembering them quite well. I just want to bring up, I brought it up in the Wake Up newsletter, but over the past 2 weeks alone, Elaine, here's a list of things that have been announced for reboots or reimaginings or regifting or whatever the term is. We have a new Matrix film, which you mentioned last week. We have Legally Blonde as a TV series. We have Bridget Jones's Diary is getting a new movie. The Blair Witch Project is getting reimagined by Blumhouse. A new Heroes series is being pitched around town. And Elaine, do you have any memories of Melrose Place at all? Is that in your radar? David, you know, I got you on that.
Remember. Very much
it's so. 90s. That's all I can do. So you remember Melrose Place, David. All right. Elaine, does that Melrose Place hold anything for you in your mind?
That was slightly before my time.
A little before your time?
Yeah. When are they going to do the One Tree Hill reboot that I'll be on board for?
Hollywood, they're listening.
You definitely should dust off your spec script for sure, Elaine.
Yeah, get that One Tree Hill spec
and do that for the reboot. And of course, Sean, not to get too far ahead of ourselves, but as you wrote about, actually not in The Anchor, but in a little publication called Vanity Fair, yes. We have another reboot from the 90s, and that is the Fight Over Paramount.
Exactly. We have a merger reboot. Exactly. That's what everybody has this week. So, and I just saw before we started recording, they're doing another scary movie as well. So like this is literally a two-week period in Hollywood. So apparently during the strikes, Elaine, everybody's just watching old TV and saying, what else can we do to remake? So
the Heroes one is the one that caught me off guard. Like, okay, all right.
Sure, I guess. Yeah. It's from the same creator, but
that was very big for a year.
Oh, I was super into Heroes the first season. Yeah,
save the cheerleader, and then I think it only ran for about 4 seasons. Anyway, you'll have your wish will be fulfilled, Elaine, if someone buys that up. But I got to say, for a town that's kind of fearful of where AI, is just going to rehash old ideas, I don't know that we're making a very compelling case for ourselves, Elaine. This is not.
Yeah, it's nostalgia week, nostalgia month in Hollywood, apparently.
Yeah, originality is not like, oh, AI has nothing original to say, and this is literally the news that comes out every 2 weeks. So anyway, our new AI overlords, we'll see what they think of these new ideas. And speaking of AI, we have a new contributor to The Ankler. Eric Barmack will be heading this up. It's called Real AI. That's R-E-E-L AI, new column looking to all things AI, Hollywood tech, our new overlords, our future bosses, David. Eric is a 25-year veteran of the entertainment and digital media business, including roles at ESPN and Netflix, where he was the head of international originals before going on to start his own production company. He has also founded and runs a news site dedicated to AI in the entertainment industry called AI in Hollywood that is quite well known. And now his crowning achievement is appearing on the Ankler podcast. Eric, welcome. Thanks for joining.
This is the pinnacle. Thanks for having me, guys.
That's what the AI told me, Eric. I asked it. I said, how could we improve Eric's career? He said, just go on the Ankler podcast. So just saying, it's where I came from.
Look what it's done for me. Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Look where it's for David. Yeah. So you had your first column this week, which everybody can, of course, check out over at theankler.com. Eric, you shared your vast experiences using AI for script coverage, walking through the things that it does well and things that you may still want to have an actual human do, but I guess why don't we start? When did you start exploring the space, and what was your, where did this all begin here, Eric?
Yeah, I mean, for us, it began because we're a four-person company and we're an internationally minded production company, and so we're trying to do 8 to 10 projects a year, almost entirely in 8 to 10 different markets, right? And so, we need to be looking at hundreds of projects. But we're a four-person team, and so we don't have the economics of a studio, and so we needed basically cheat codes to be able to be competitive in lots of different markets all at once. And then we thought that, if we were good at this and we learned about it, that it may give us a competitive advantage over time. And part two of what's driven this is just the notion that AI isn't black or white. It's not entirely good or bad. It's useful in different contexts and not useful at all in other contexts. So, like, being able to sort of have practical uses for AI and to recognize the nuance in the topic is something that's been important to us.
How long have you been using it? And it's evolved even, since the first ChatGPT thing, was announced. So how long has this evolution been for you?
I mean, it's been pretty rapid. We've basically been looking at it over the last 18 months. And, we've started with ChatGPT like everyone else. And then what is this and how do we use it? And going through this notion of training your ChatGPT. And then more recently, we've been working on with other applications like Claude and ScriptSense as well.
Yeah. And you've been finding some pretty significant differences between the different, options out there. So walk us through what the landscape is here in terms of as a tool for script coverage.
Well, so mostly it's more similar than it is different, which is it is incredibly, all of these applications are incredibly good at summarizing and sort of analyzing on the surface what the genre is, what happens, and then basically writing up script coverage in a way that's reasonable, where if you had no opinion about the quality of the writing, you could at least determine whether the subject matter and the general plot and the genre is of interest to you. And then there's, there's a different layer, I would say, around things like, okay, you can write a summary, but can you write a compelling summary? Can you write a log line? And AI in general still isn't great at log lines. It can't read nuance. So it can tell you what's happened. It can boil everything in a movie down to 30 words, but it doesn't know, or we haven't experienced it telling us whether a surprise is important or not. So the example we gave in the article is like, if it was doing a log line around Sixth Sense, it would, you would see dead people straight away. And that might not work if you're trying to pitch the movie. Very, very good at summaries. Less good, but reasonable as a starting point at log lines. Not good at all yet relative to humans in telling you if a script is good or bad.
Right.
And so, you know, like part of what we've been talking about is a company is like, it's not an on or off switch. So like we save hundreds of hours in sort of considering what type of genres we're going to pursue, what's available in which different markets. We're not using AI to tell us whether a script is good or bad.
Right, right. And you mentioned the piece is also, you know, this, which is kind of, I guess, against what one would think, but it can be a good thing for screenwriters in some regard. So what were your thinking in terms of how screenwriters maybe should view this technology?
Well, look, I mean, there's all sorts of ethical implications, which right. our article doesn't completely consider yet, but like, are you training the overlord? And what happens right. if you funnel this stuff into big data? You know, what does that mean?
Right. It's legit.
These are legit considerations. I would say it's very good at spitballing. Like we're lonely, like it, meaning, you know, we have people working around the world. We're not in the same office. And it's like, you know, if we're kind of thinking about like, okay, we're in Mexico. We want to tell a spiritual story about a saint, what saints have had movies done about them. And it goes well beyond Google search, right? Because it's all of a sudden you can sort of say like, you know, here's a bunch of different ideas that you can spitball against. So Claude in particular is, if you were to ask it, you know, what could be a good thriller with these considerations in mind? Again, would not write the script. It would not write a good story, but it would give you a bunch of ideas. So it's good at that. I think it's also good at telling you what your story is about. Meaning, I think there's a value for having AI summarize your script because maybe your script isn't what you think it is. So like, for example, we looked at a thriller and we were sort of knew intuitively that something was off about the thriller, though we liked the writing and we liked the dialogue. And we put it through Claude in this case. And what came back was that Claude was viewing it as a drama. It was viewing it as a relationship. And then we went back and looked and said, well, the first two acts are actually quite slow. There's not thriller points that would signal to sort of an objective third party that this is in that genre.
Right, right. Which may not translate to the screen or you know, yeah, like maybe we need to beef this part of the story up.
Right. And it's the part that sort of, it drives me a little nuts of the doomsayers of like this being all bad. It's like, well, no, we actually learned something about this script and then went back to the human writer and said, here's a consideration. We actually had an aha moment because of our interactions with Claude. And the writer agreed with the notes. And we wouldn't have come to that without sort of at least having that filter.
Do you think does it have a good sense of humor? You think comedy can judge? Is this a funny script?
Terrible at comedy.
All right, fair enough. Not every genre is proof for it. Yeah, yeah. So, you know, what does this mean for, you know, we're here in, April 2024. What does this mean for the industry ahead, for assistance? Give us your crystal ball here after your experience using these tools so far.
Well, look, there's the slightly more negative angle, which I don't particularly believe in. But let's say this is Detroit in 1978 and, you know, robots are coming online in the auto industry. And we're like, everybody's like, we don't like robots. Well, it's like, too bad they're coming. cars are going to be made in a different way that you can't exactly avoid. And so there's going to be this massive negative disruption and jobs are going to be lost and all that sort of stuff. That would be the, in my mind, the extreme case of coverage and junior assistance that AI gets better and better and then you don't need those people. I don't particularly believe that. Like what I think is more likely to happen is that the world of media, which you guys cover every day, is becoming more and more complex. It's becoming more international. There's so many different ways that you can make shows and movies that blend together that didn't exist before. And so really, a lot of executives on both the network and studio side are going to have to get better at using their time to find stories that resonate with global audiences, given that our worlds become inordinately more complex than when we were just cable or even 40 years ago when we were just three networks. And so you're buying time to do the things that didn't require a lot of thought, but that our jobs are all collectively becoming more complex. And that's the argument that I tend to buy. I don't feel like there's going to be fewer jobs in media 20 years from now. I think there's going to be different jobs that are going to require people having an understanding of how data works and how to use these tools productively.
Great. No, it's a great read, Eric. It's a really in-depth look and you're getting some nuts and bolts there, but okay, here you go. Good this, not this. So it was a really good overview there for people who have, like myself, I've read about these things, these developments. I've never used it or interfaced with it. And you've had a lot of experience with it so far to really point out where it's at now and, the things that you said, good at, bad at, and, where the jobs might be coming and going as the business evolves here.
That is very much what we're excited about and working with Eric, that to have someone who is both, in the business and actively using and experimenting with these tools to be able to offer both those perspectives to Anchor readers, we feel is invaluable.
Yeah, it's not, this isn't in the lab. This is, this is on the street. Very practical here, which I love, so.
We're in the boots on the ground business. So yeah, we're excited to pursue this. And I think it's a really exciting time and there's going to be a lot more to say. And, so we're excited to be covering it.
Fantastic. All right, again, you can check out that column over at theankler.com. The column is Real AI. Eric, thanks for joining. And I'm sure we'll have you or your AI avatar back soon.
All right, thanks for having me, guys.
All right, shifting gears. Elaine, in your series business column this week, you celebrated, or maybe we'll just say noted.
I think celebrated's a strong word, Sean.
Strong word. Yeah. Memorialized about the one-year anniversary here of the big Disney layoff process of 2023, which was on top of WBD, and Paramount had a couple of rounds of layoffs down the line. So 1 year later, how's it going out there? What'd you find in your column this week?
Like you said, between Disney and Paramount and Warner's, it's a tough anniversary that we're coming up on. I mean, between March and May alone, Disney laid off 7,000 people last year during this time. And then you look at the way that Warner's restructured, you have a lot of studio executives left out in the dust right now. People who lost their jobs right around the time the strike was beginning. It was just a tough year, tough job market overall, between the cost cutting at the studios, between the labor stoppages. And 1 year later, many of them find themselves still without work. And, we're not talking about like C-suiters who have yachts. Mm-hmm. We're talking about people who have been in the business and have been working hard at it for 5, 10, 20 years. People still worried about retirement, putting their kids through college. So I caught up with some of them, some of whom I'd known since last year, some of whom I had just met for this story, to get a sense of what their lives have been like. And it's been tough. A lot of them tell me that there aren't that many jobs that are available. And the ones that they do apply for, they don't hear back. You're looking at these HR portals where you're just trying to get through to a phone screen. You're trying to sift through the LinkedIn job applications.
LinkedIn, yeah.
It's just really tough. And one SVP level executive told me that they're actually looking and have been talking to friends who are in the same position about taking a pay cut by as much as 50% in order to be seen as a viable candidate for a job to stay in the industry.
Yeah, that's the tough part. I mean, if those SVP jobs are not being created, Elaine, let's say you price yourself out of the market, right? Mm-hmm. And it's like people don't even think of you because, they won't want this job because it doesn't pay as much or the title may not be the same. But if you're out of work for a year, it's like, not to say you can't be picky about things, but I mean, they'd be qualified and then like, you're too qualified or, it gets to be, it's just tough. I don't know. I don't know what they'll say about it, really.
Yeah, and it's tough at every level, too, because you're looking at younger aspirants, people who want to break into Hollywood who are like, oh, maybe now's not a good time to. You look at people, and I've certainly heard this from a number of different people, of those looking to take early retirement, of maybe leaving the industry a year or two earlier than they would have because the job market, because the business is so tough right now. But, you know, it's not all bad news. I was talking to a recruiter from Korn Ferry, Bill Simon, who specializes in entertainment and executive recruiting. And he said he's expecting a renaissance, so to speak, in 25 or 2026, which, of course, if you're out of a job now, sounds very far away still. But he sees it as more of a cyclical downturn. Although that's kind of like I feel like part of the debate, right? Of like, well, is this, how cyclical is this current downturn versus how much of a permanent crunch and a permanent squeeze is this on the industry?
Yeah, but if you're at a one-year mark and if you had 1 year severance, whoever it might be, it's, you know, it's April. So, you know, we still have 8 months left until 2025. So comforting words to some degree, but maybe not in others. But you also kind of mentioned and touch on some examples of people just, you know, starting their own shingles and kind of becoming more entrepreneurial, not waiting for a job to fill, but really doing their own thing. So that's something people are really coming around to. Maybe they were at a company for 20 years and now they're, you know, they're starting their own endeavor.
Yeah. Something a former TV marketing executive mentioned to me is that there used to be a stigma around starting your own thing. It was kind of seen as like, oh, they couldn't get a job elsewhere.
They couldn't get a job, right?
They had to start up their own thing. And now the pendulum has really swung to the other corner. And it's more of like, well, this person's entrepreneurial. They've been able to find the capital to start up their own thing. It's really not seen as like a consolation prize anymore. And, you know, just a couple of examples we've seen from some very senior level Warner Brothers folks who left, like, you know, Tricia Melton and Tom Asheim now have their Pith and Pixie Dust consultancy. You know, you have the former heads of Unscripted over at Warner's, Jennifer O'Connell and Rebecca Quinn, who now have their own nonfiction production company, Velvet Hammer. And, you know, these are definitely not seen as sort of consolations. These are seen as like, wow, okay, they've been able to go out there and find projects in the midst of everything happening right now.
Yeah, and even across other, like PR, I think, you know, Christy Chan, who is also at Warner Bros. Discovery, has started a new company as well with someone. So, you know, yeah, I think production, PR, marketing, it's not just, you know, one sector, Elaine.
It's broad-based.
It's exactly. And, you know, David, I think, you know, Elaine talked about that stigma, and it is, I don't know, obviously it's based on perspective here, but I do feel like, you know, through COVID and then this, I think, you know, that what Elaine says about like, oh, they couldn't get a job somewhere else. Like, I think now that a lot of that's gone away, David, what is your take reading Lynn's report in general here?
Yeah, I would hope that people do take to heart that idea that this is a good opportunity to try to forge your own path, be your own boss. You know, certainly there are trade-offs with that, you know, health insurance probably being the biggest one, but one can buy health insurance, but you understand what I'm saying. But, you know, but yeah, I think that given that there is no stigma and that just all the instability in the industry, being able to control your own fate, you know, should be seen as, you know, having more appeal. And, you know, and if that then leads to, yeah, there being more competition and more opportunity for people, you know, it should lead to just a more vibrant business on the whole. So, you know, as hard as a lot of the details in Elaine's story are, you know, I think there is, you know, a little bit of a positive note that I hope people take away.
Yeah, I think, Elaine, you know, I mean, you're very real about it, Elaine, but I think that this, you know, for those who are motivated, it is, can be, you know, somewhat inspiring at the end, Elaine.
Yeah. Although just getting through the initial interview process is, for anybody who's ever looked for a job, it's tough. You know, you go, daunting. You jump through these hoops, you send in your applications online. And what one former studio exec was telling me was that unless you have somebody big in your corner who's able to put in a phone call for you, man, getting through the digital hurdles is very difficult right now.
Yeah, and that doesn't even guarantee you the job. It just gets you, you know, in the door, maybe, you know, Elaine, too, that phone call. So anyway, a great read. Again, you can check it out in Elaine's series business column over there at theankler.com. All right, up next, we're going to dive into all things Paramount Global, who's still will have a week here, David. So speaking of jobs, there's a few openings on the board. Maybe we'll dive into that. Plus, we'll check in with Richard on the ground in Vegas at CinemaCon to see what movies are impressing him so far. And more importantly, what new concession food is impressing him as well. We'll be back in a moment. All right. So, David, Paramount's having a week. We should clarify that we're recording here around lunchtime on Thursday. So it's entirely possible that more things will happen before this week is out. David, this is unusual amount of activity even or news breaking even for this kind of thing. No?
Yeah, there definitely appears to be somewhat of an open door policy when it comes to the boardroom and the C-suite, because Paramount is leaking like a sieve.
Yeah. I'll try to recap this as briefly as I can here, but just to bring everybody up to speed. The week kind of started with the Wall Street Journal reporting that the Skydance plan afoot was for David Ellison, KKR, and Redbird there, potentially with some, maybe Larry Ellison in the mix there, but we'll see, for those guys to buy out.
I hope so.
Yeah.
The Larry Ellison is the wild card that just really is. We'll get to it, but yes.
Exactly. We'll get there. So we'll put a pin in it, but it's there. Anyway, for that consortium to buy out Shire Redstone's National Amusements, which essentially has 77% of the voting control of Paramount, the voting stock, for about $2 billion, which is a premium on the stock's current worth. Then Paramount, after that, would then acquire Skydance. So Paramount as a company would still exist, and that would be an all-stock deal for about $5 billion. Which would then, in theory, dilute the value of the stock, the publicly traded common stock of Paramount. There's more details to come there. Maybe there's some stock buybacks to help up that value, or, you know, that was a little bit murky. But regardless, you know, according to Axios, some Paramount common stockholders, larger PE firms, Matrix Asset, Blackwood Capital, were two of the bigger ones that issued sternly worded letters being basically like, not cool, bro, and maybe to borrow a phrase from The Social Network, you better lawyer up. You know, I think it's probably the sentiment, not in those words, but, you know, they were not happy about this. And then another report from the WSJ yesterday indicated that four of the Paramount board members are going to step down, quote, in the coming weeks, three of whom were on that Paramount internal, or probably still are, arguably, on that Paramount internal deal committee, which is evaluating the sales offers here. And that's four board members out of 11 seats on a board who were leaving.
That does sound like a lot. I stopped doing math after I graduated high school, but that does sound like a lot to me.
You don't need to know math to know that doesn't sound, and is rather rare, David. That's not something, you know, board members tend not to leave en masse from a board unless something's really going on there. So, David, that's kind of the latest and greatest as far as I know. I'll check and see if any alerts came in here, but let's pick up the board here. What's going on? And when you looked at the you know, behind the scenes here at the board.
Yeah. Well, you laid out some interesting, you know, possible scenarios in Thursday edition of The Wake Up, you know, one of which is that, yeah, they are effectively aligned with the shareholders, with those firms who wrote their sterling worded letters, that, yeah, this does not seem cool to them and does not feel like it's in the best interest of all the shareholders. And so they're like, yeah, we're out, you know. All the best. You know, this has been a lot of fun, but goodbye. And yeah, so that's one option, right? And then the other, which is interesting, is whether they're leaving because, yeah, there's basically a new board, you know, being set up to come in, you know, that Sherry and David Ellison, his backers, you know, are effectively setting up for the forthcoming, but unannounced, as we'll get to, annual shareholder meeting probably sometime this spring that would basically help get this incredibly complicated deal through, right? So,
yeah, I mean, a smaller board, you know, there's no word if they're going to replace these seats. They can certainly they don't have to replace them. The board can go to a 7-person board, which may make a deal easier in some regard. It doesn't get rid of the shareholder concern or any lawsuits out of the way. That's, you know, irrelevant in that regard, but it may make it things internally be easier to maneuver potentially, you know, again. Yeah. All theoretical.
One thing that is strange, at least with the report of who's departing, the two people who have any meaningful operational experience in the entertainment industry, Don Ostroff, who most recently at Spotify, who once worked for the CBS joint venture, the CW programming, she is one of the people leaving, and Nicole Seligman, the former president of Sony Entertainment, also is on that list of people leaving. So, you know, if they're gone, the only people left are pretty much finance people, career finance people, many of them, you know, septuagenarians. And it does make one wonder about the makeup of that board. And again, does feel like it would also lead, you know, just seems to have a large loud bell on it for shareholder lawsuits.
Yeah, and one of them is Redstone's personal lawyer, which is also another board member who left. Yes. I'm like, well, that's an interesting development, whether that's, you know, again, I want to avoid conflict of interest or what, you know, like, again, there's no stated line in terms of what the actual reasoning, and we'll see what that, what transpires. But just as when the lawyer of the head person here leaves the board of the company, it's like, it raises an eyebrow. And as I wrote in the wake up this morning, and you've been looking into the background of these people as well, one of the board members who's still there was a former president of Oracle, which is, of course, Larry Ellison's company. He was a president from, I think, 2003 to 2010. So yes, there is someone on the board who has a history with Oracle and the Ellisons to that degree.
Which is fine. Could go any number of ways, sure, to be clear, because Larry Ellison, not renowned as the most cuddly figure, and working for him, you know, generally considered to be, you know, a particularly trying assignment. Sure,
but there's a relationship there, certainly. They know each other. Yeah, who
but
knows?
Yes, they certainly, yes, they worked together for almost a decade in a pretty senior capacity, yes.
But the earnings call is on April 29th, be there or be square. But then I also looked at this week, you know, like there's a lot of focus on the deal, the minutiae, all this other news is certainly building on top of that. But, you know, I zoomed out a bit earlier in the week in the wake up, just like, what are we buying here? You know, I mean, when Ellison, if this happens, again, very, very, very big if at this point, the Apollo thing is still very much in the background there, the $26 billion offer for the company at large, Paramount Global. But, you know, the company is being sold for a reason, David. This isn't a position of strength, I think, that they're operating from. I mean, they're levered, they have $14 billion in debt. It's pretty much 5x leveraged. There's a reason we're at this point, David.
The not money making, but the growth part of the business, you know, which is the streaming, is, you know, what, 20 something percent now, but it's not, you know, growing as fast as the linear declining assets are, you know, diminishing. And so, yeah, this is definitely a bit of a burning platform, if you will. And I think certainly given some of the players involved, there's going to be a bit of a breakup, much as we talked about last week with Endeavor. But certain things you can't quite break up, right? Like we talked about, you wrote about CBS. I mean, they certainly want the NFL rights, but
yeah,
do they really want the rest of it? Probably not. How do you manage that?
Exactly. I mean, you know, as much as the focus has kind of been on the studio, you know, which is vaunted, it has a library.
Clearly, they want the studio, and great.
Which is great. But the movie studio itself is about 10% of the revenues in 2023. If you include the library sales of film and TV, it's maybe 20, you know, about 20%. What you're buying here is a linear TV business. 55% of Paramount's revenues in 2023 were literally from linear TV. Not even, you know, the streaming business was about 23%. It's growing, as you said, it's, you know, up about 39% year over year in streaming. But, you know, if you're looking at what you're walking in the door with, that's what you're getting. I mean, mostly, you know, I don't care if his plans are for the studio, whatever, that's great. But what is your plan for, as you said, CBS and MTV and Comedy Central and TV Land, and this is what's all still driving the revenue and is going in essentially one direction. There was another piece this week in Ad Age talking to some upfront buyers, major buyers of the agencies, and there was nobody optimistic that upfront buying is going to be, you know, they're like flat would be lucky, essentially was the gist there. So that business is not going to, you know, necessarily turn around. So
Sean, you don't think that vaunted a Oracle AI will the targeted advertising will be just so good that people will have to buy it.
The AI will change linear television. So we're alluding, you know, so the report in the journal also laid out, you know, what is Ellison thinking here? What is his plan here? And there's a couple of things, David, and AI was mentioned, and also cloud computing to help things. And you looked into these numbers as well.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that, you know, so you talked to, you know, Eric Barmack, you know, also on this show. And as much as AI, I think, can be, you know, an important tool, as much as I think that companies like, you know, Meta, which obviously, you know, owns Facebook and Instagram, can use its, you know, well-developed AI prowess to better target advertising, there's no evidence whatsoever. I don't even know what Oracle's AI is. I've been following this, you know, for quite some time, have not heard Oracle in that conversation at all. It is, at this point, at best, in seventh place in the cloud computing business with maybe 2% of the market, way right. behind Amazon, right. Microsoft, Google,
and Google,
yeah. you know, several other players. You know, that this feels like both some hand waving to use the magic words to try to get people excited, you know, as opposed to actually having exciting technology that could be transformative.
Real tactics here, yeah.
And yeah, and I think that, you know, if Larry Ellison, who, you know, co-founded Oracle and is, I think, still the chairman, certainly still heavily invested in that business, if he's going to help this bid of his son, it's certainly not out of any, you know, sort of a fatherly love. It is about right. trying to prop up yeah. Oracle and getting it involved, you know, in streaming and trying to use Pluto and Paramount Plus, you know, as a bit of a reference customer to try to woo, you know, more business to Oracle to prove that it can do it in the same way that I think Netflix was an early customer of Amazon Web Services and helped, you know, prove out that it could handle that kind of load successfully. And you know, I think definitely, you know, at least anecdotally, help grow Amazon's business. And I think whatever, 10 years later, this is, you know, what Ellison might have in mind. It feels very hopeful, let's say, very fanciful, if you will.
Okay, yeah, that may be the better word there. But, you know, look, in a world where connected TV advertising, streaming advertising is clearly where the dollars are shifting, and that was also in that report from the media buyers, you know, yeah, maybe there are some, it is about your data. And, you know, so if there are things they can do to make, again, more user data to up your advertising business, that's fine. But again, it's not going to yeah. help you sell more ads on Ghost but on Thursday is, night, which is right. kind of where most of your money is right now.
As you pointed out, you know, that was AT&T's idea too. when it bought Time Warner, that did not yeah. work. And I don't think that is going to work either. I mean, certainly if that's the narrative, like, I don't know. I don't know how you could sort of
not a strong
be convinced
suit.
By that. No.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, to bring it back to where this whole conversation started, like, yeah, we're back in 90s nostalgia when, you know, all those networks were, you know, exciting and generated a ton of cash and had multiple revenue streams and were cool. And, you know, let's pretend that we're back in, you know, in that time period.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we shall see. But in the end, you know, the cable networks may not stick around, you know, who knows if this deal goes through, but I don't see how
in terms of what they're buying, they're buying a nostalgic vision in some way of what this was as opposed to what it is.
Yeah. But we'll see how big the company remains if this deal goes through. That would be something I would keep an eye on in terms of losing assets to gain better business, if you will. But more to come, as David alluded to. So I will, of course, be covering all that as the saga continues in The Wake Up. Rounding out here at the box office this weekend, we have A24 Civil War leading the way, very broadly tracking around $20 million. So we'll see where that ends up on Sunday. I'll, of course, cover that in The Wake Up newsletter on Sunday night, as always. But more importantly than that, our man Richard is at the beating heart of the movie business right now in Las Vegas. Richard has been at CinemaCon all week, the annual gathering of movie theater owners, movie food purveyors in the desert, where movie studios show up to give previews of what I'm sure will be all big hits. Elaine, everything's going to be a roaring success, right, Elaine?
Oh, absolutely. Of course. How could it be otherwise?
Yeah, of course. And we have bringing our big stars, rah-rah vibes, you know, yay movies. So let's bring in Mr. Rushfield right now. Richard, how is Las Vegas treating you?
It's been a big week here. We're all getting through. I survive a week of on living on hors d'oeuvres alone.
So what's the vibe? You know, you wrote a little bit about it this week in your column at the Yankler here. So, you know, you've been to CinemaCon several years, Richard. Anything standing out for you about here in 2024?
You know, the theater owners usually just sort of have mindless optimism towards the future. Like, oh, there's three Dwayne Johnson movies coming this year. Everything's going to be fine. This is the first time that I get little murmurs of actual nervousness. But the reaction to what has been shown is good. But I had one theater owner just spell it out for me. He said, we need 120 movies a year. If we only have 100, then it's down 20%. And that means our revenues are off 20%. That's just the math. How does it? So they're just looking at it and saying, well, this is not the volume that we need, even though there's a lot of things that look good. And also it's just the loop of if people aren't in the theaters, they're not seeing the trailers and they're not, then the excitement isn't building for the next thing and that you're just depressing the entire cycle there. So just a lot of murmurs of concern about that.
Yeah, and I saw a thing with Adam Aaron, who, of course, runs AMC Theaters, the number one theater chain in America. And, you know, he was saying, yeah, we closed, you know, I think it was 160 screens or locations, you know, but we opened 90, and those ones that we opened make more money for us than the one, you know, not every theater is a winner, Richard, you know. So it's, I think that's a kind of paring back, or however you want to refer to it, but, you know, which isn't, you know, isn't great, but it is healthy in maybe the longer term for these theaters, so...
As long as it's an improvement and upgrade of the basic plan.
Well, right, yeah, exactly.
Not the beginning of a death spiral. So that's the question. Are you replacing them? Are there communities that no longer have movie theaters?
Well, right, exactly. Yeah, because that also means that some Americans maybe, you know, 50 miles to go see a movie or something like that, which, you know, would be, I can't even imagine that.
Which means you take them off the chart of movie consumers. So your potential audience just got smaller. So
yeah, there is collateral damage there for sure. But all right, well, you know, you've actually seen all the good stuff. We only get to read about it and say, well, this looked great. And I'm like, yeah, okay, sure. Like, you know, so what's the big hit, Richard? What's standing out for you in terms of the previews of all the stuff to come this year?
Well, so last night was Universal, and their big thing was Wicked, and they're very excited about Wicked.
Are you very excited about it, Richard?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know that I'm the target audience necessarily, but it looks like a big spectacle. They're definitely hiding that it's a musical. There's no evidence to be found that this is a musical.
again with Hollywood, yeah. And this was a Broadway musical. It's not even a...
But, I mean, it looks like a pretty... major impressive Oz-like spectacle there. So,
all right. What else?
The big thing that caught my eye was I was a really impressive slate from the Universal presenter Focus.
Oh, okay.
They have this movie, a murder mystery about a pope.
Oh yeah, from the director of All Quiet on the Western Front. Yeah,
that all looked really fascinating. So, in that earlier in the day we had Lionsgate, which seem to be taking a lot of big swings. I don't know if they just made every trailer look giant, but it looked like a lot of big movies there. We will see how they play. There's this one, Borderlands.
Yeah, coming out. Yeah, that's the thing in August, I think. And the Michael Jackson movie, I think, wasn't that part of it?
That was the other big one. So,
and Ballerina, the Wick movie, I guess, right?
Wasn't Ballerina, it? They're so excited about it that they've decided to give it the opportunity to film entirely new action sequences.
The opportunity to do so. That's good, Richard.
They're going to take another year to seize that opportunity. It will not be coming out this year, but that's a sign of how excited they are about it. So
yeah. And Warner Brothers as well, Richard.
And Warner Brothers was the day before, and had a lot of movies that looked interesting. Furioso's.
I mean, the trailers look fantastic. The visuals alone are just, and the sound, and it's really, you know. I mean, it's George Miller, so I'm not, you know, not surprising, but it does remind you of that visual power.
Yeah, they have what looks like a full slate of big swings there. So
yeah, no, I looked ahead. They had what the number was, but it was 8 or 9 movies from Oscar nominated directors in the next 12 months. You know, I mean, then it was a pretty diverse, you know, a diverse slate. I think you wrote in your column, it was like, you know, a couple of, you know, tentpoles, a couple of, you know, it was pretty diverse in its slate, I think, was the takeaway.
The narrative on Warner has been so centered right on the David Zaslav drama.
Who was not there, by the way, who was not there this year.
So mainly not, you know, seemed to be so happy being on the stage last year. I thought he would be here forever. But frankly, it was unusual for a CEO to be here like that. No other companies.
True.
They have their CEO, so it's turned it over to the film crew, which is how everyone else does it. But they're doing what is a traditional slate there. A couple animations, a couple from DC, a couple from New Line, and a couple right. Sort of traditional Warner things, but we'll see. And Joker 2 was the big one, I think, that coming out. That I asked Rich Gelfond, head of IMAX, who every year I've asked him to predict what will be the biggest film of the year, and he's had a pretty good track record of it. And he's called a 3-way tie between Despicable Me, Joker 2, and Deadpool was.
That's why we released the movies, Richard. We see what happens. And Paramount's still to come. So you're going to certainly wrap all this stuff up in your next column, I suppose?
Yeah, Paramount and Disney today and the CinemaCon Awards.
Okay. What are you up for, Richard?
Kevin Costner was presented with his Visionary Award during the Warners panel when he was out there promoting Horizon. So we already know who's going to receive the...
All right. Spoiler alert. Yeah. Award.
But a lot of big names there.
Yeah. Well, Richard, I can't let you go without talking about the food. All right. Were you on the convention floor? What's anything catch your eye in terms of the other part of this CinemaCon that goes out there besides the previews here?
Yeah, it's always really the new NATO head, Michael O'Leary, led a tour of the trade show. So we went through it and talked to the people who make all the new seats and sound systems. We talked to the company that made the infamous Dune.
Oh, okay. Wow, the Dune popcorn bucket. Yeah.
We saw those. They can come up with custom ones.
Oh, apparently, yeah. They can get very creative.
And then the food innovations continue. We're especially struck by a Skittles mix your own Skittles mix machine, where you can choose exactly how many grape Skittles you want and how many lemon, and create your own special Skittles mix. And then it's always just the attempts to mash together all different kinds of foods into one thing. I think what broke me was the chicken and cheese hot honey hot dog. Deep fried.
How many did you have?
Deep fried, of course. I had a bite of at least in my reporting.
Exactly. So. Make sure you get a thorough report, Richard. So we'll look forward to all the photos and stuff. You're always very, the ace photographer, Richard Rushfield, I'm sure, is at it again. So we'll get some good visuals. You had some in there earlier already in your column this week. So some more to come there for sure. And security is a little tight this year, Richard. You doing okay there?
It's interesting because piracy was the big theme of
Charles Rifkin's opening speech,
state of the industry speech. He talked about their pursuit of legislation for it, but they have launched a real crackdown on any piracy within the CinemaCon, not in the theaters in general, but here at CinemaCon. And anybody who takes out a cell phone, you have security down your throat in seconds. Wow. And I was summoned out of the conclave to security and told I had been identified as someone who had videotaped the proceedings, and they needed to see me delete my tape. So I was summoned out to security during the middle of the Lionsgate demonstration, and then told by security, "You need to hand over your phone to us for inspection." And I informed them I'm a working reporter. There is sensitive material on that phone, and I will not do that. And they said, "Well, then we have to place you under arrest." And we had quite a standoff before they compromised on. I would hold up my phone and show them the last photo, which was taken the night before, and show them, "No, I did not pirate your marketing materials." So
just taking pictures of hot dogs, people. That's all it is.
No, there was a lot of solemn invocations of security must come first. And I'm like, you're not actually saving people's lives here. You're protecting marketing materials from
leaking. Yeah.
But, you know, I was almost a political prisoner here, but...
Exactly. Yeah, I'm glad you made it out. I'm glad you could come and make an appearance here on the podcast, Richard, and share to live another day here. So, well, be careful out there today, Richard. You can, of course, catch Richard's recap in the next column over there at theankler.com. And Richard will be finally fully back on the pod next week. We missed you, Richard. It's been a couple of weeks here.
Disneyland and CinemaCon.
Exactly. So we'll have you back regularly as a full podcast member here at The Ankler next week. Richard, enjoy the rest of CinemaCon.
Thank you. Good to talk to you.
All right. And David, the Players Tournament finished up. We have a congrats to the young whippersnapper, Walt Disney. You know,
yeah,
I guess we still send an Ankler hat signed by Richard to somebody.
Sure. It's going to look great on top of the cryogenically frozen container, right? That'll be a cool picture. The Ankler hat on top of that.
Elaine, do we give Spielberg something for second place? I mean, come on. That's pretty good.
two ankler hats? Like,
wow, two ankler hats. Oh, okay, I don't know. I was going to say maybe a song sung by Richard, a serenade or something.
Well, that's that would priceless, be my, you know,
Sean. Yeah, that is true. We cannot put a price on that. But a big thanks to all of you who participated and voted in that and made it a fun thing for a couple of weeks here at the Ankler to follow. So we appreciate that. And just a note here to check out, we have a new Serious Business column from Minori, which just dropped today, which dives into all things TV sales on the global stage, and frankly, seems like a mess that's building between MIP and the London screenings conferences. Who's showing up, the cost, who's buying, who's not showing up, conflicting dates. I mean, a pretty fascinating read. I didn't know a lot about this part, and it was really interesting to see. Again, international sales for TV series is a big business, and funds a lot of things that, you know, that are outside the US and inside the US.
It's like when the two Meteor movies were scheduled for the same time. but with international buying markets in London.
It's just
in
like that, David. Yeah.
Exactly.
That didn't make the piece, I don't think. That analogy was not in the piece, but you know, it was right there. Yeah, it was right there. So anyway, highly recommend you can go check that out over at theangler.com. Elaine, of course, will have a new Serious Business next week, and Richard will be back in his normal writing cadence, freshly back from the casinos, convention halls of Las Vegas. And we, of course, be back fully here on the pod next week. And Elaine, is your calculator watch handy?
Yeah, what are we doing next week?
Elaine, the enthusiasm, a little more of something? No?
What is just, it? Earnings season isn't around
every
the
bend
time,
again,
like,
Sean, is it? What are you doing, man? What do you got? What do you got? Yes, it is earnings season yet again next week. Beginning, it seems like it just ended.
I gotta say, there was an extra short period of time between earnings seasons this time
you
around.
You are correct, yes. Earnings season went until the very end of February, which was an extra day, February 29th this year. So we are starting a mere 6 weeks later, basically. Netflix kicks things off, the Q1 festivities on Thursday, so I'll have all the numbers and context to know in my wake up newsletter, of course, putting my media nerd glasses back on and seeing what's really afoot inside the numbers, all of which you get as part of your Ankler subscription, giving you access to all newsletters and podcasts here at the Ankler. Subscribe at theankler.com. And remember, vote for those Webbies, folks. That link is right there in the show notes. Take 15 seconds and give us a vote if you would. And you can email us anytime at podcasts@theankler.com and follow the Ankler on the socials. At the Ankler across any and all social platforms. Great to see both of you, Elaine and David. A thanks to Eric for joining as well, and to Richard, of course, who will be back next week. And a thanks to you all for listening. We'll see you next time.